Good evening, everybody. This is about the only time I'll be standing tonight because my back is killing me. I had duty going up and down the stairs with my wife all weekend. I can barely stand. My name is John Horrigan, and tonight is a lecture called Great Shipwrecks of the American Revolution. It's the debut of this lecture, and I appreciate the Lincoln Minutemen, Ruth, Steve, and all my fellow men and women for giving me this opportunity. They've given me the opportunity to speak about winners of the Revolution, great fires of the Revolution, Henry Knox Cannon Train and Evacuation Day, and New England's Dark Day. So this is the fifth and hopefully not the final part of the series. I'm also recording this lecture tonight for the Massachusetts Association for the Blind. I read to the blind, I go into senior centers and work with seniors, so you'll see the way I drive the text and the narration off of my slides for two reasons. Number one, it's easy for the elderly, and number two, I'm very lazy and can't memorize a 45-minute speech. So just want to let you know about that. Couple things about me. I'm a New England folklorist. I don't dare call myself a historian. A historical raconteur, perhaps. I specialize in historical fires, battle anomalies, classic weather, and economic events. I'm already in my professional sports announcer voice. I work with the Boston Bruins alumni, New England Patriots, so I apologize in advance if I break out into a play-by-play. I also produce the Historapalooza, New England History Festival, coming this November 13th in Watertown, Mass. Edgar Allan Poe and Ralph Waldo Emerson will be appearing. I have gotten them together, historyfestival.org. And, of course, I'm a member here, a proud member of the Lincoln Minutemen. My website is ushistory.me or johnhorrigan@hotmail.com. Shipwrecks of the Revolution. Well, as the 13 colonies had a very tiny fleet, providential weather would serve as a formidable navy for the 13 colonies. This lecture examines some of the major storms of the American Revolution and their impact on the fight for independence with a slant on shipwrecks. Ships were wrecked in battle. We will not examine major naval engagements unless weather became a factor. I'm not a battle guy in the Revolution, I'll be the first to admit. I can tell you about storms and little tornadoes and things like that, and I'm strong on the Knox Cannon Train, but battles, correct me if you see some information, because my sources tonight are, amongst many, are David Ludlam and, dare I say, Edward Rowe Snow, as we know who took liberties. Tonight's lecture, we're going to look at the Gaspé Affair, the Independence Hurricane, a Hurricane of Providence, the Storm of October 1778, the Wreck of the Somerset, the Wreck of the General Arnold, and then, time permitting, and I can stop right there, we can look at Dunbar's Hurricane, the Occupation Storm, the Triple Hurricanes of 1780, unbelievable devastation, the Wreck of the Earth Pins, and the Victory Anti-Cyclone of Chesapeake Bay. Just how, if winds change, it can change an American Revolution. Just some shipwrecks there. The Gaspé Affair. Well, the Gaspé Affair was a significant event in the lead-up to the American Revolution. HMS Gaspé, a British revenue schooner that had been enforcing unpopular trade regulations, ran aground in shallow water on June 9, 1772, near what is known as Gaspé Point in the city of Warwick, Rhode Island, while she was chasing the packet boat Hannah. In a notorious act of defiance, American patriots, led by Abraham Whipple and John Brown, attacked, boarded, looted, and torched the ship. The customs service in Britain's North American colonies in the 18th century had a violent history, and the treasury in London did little to correct that problem. After the Seven Years' War, Parliament wanted to raise more revenue in the colonies. The revenue was necessary, Parliament believed, to bolster military and naval defensive positions along the borders of their far-flung empire and to pay the crushing debt incurred in winning the war on behalf of those colonies. Among these reforms was the deputizing of the Royal Navy's sea officers to help enforce custom laws in colonial ports. These new powers were abused. There were retaliatory attacks prior to the Gaspé Affair. In 1764, Rhode Islanders attacked HMS St. John, and in 1769, they burned a custom ship HMS Liberty on Goat Island in Newport Harbor. In early 1772, Lieutenant William Duddingston sailed HMS Gaspé into Rhode Island's Narragansett Bay to aid in the enforcement of customs collection and inspection of cargo. Rhode Island had a reputation for smuggling and trading with the enemy during wartime. Duddingston and his officers quickly antagonized powerful merchant interests in the small colony. On June 9, 1772, the Gaspé gave chase to the packet boat Hannah and ran aground in shallow water on the northwestern side of the bay. Her crew was unable to free her immediately, but the rising tide might have allowed the ship to free herself. A band of Providence members of the Sons of Liberty rowed out to confront the ship's crew before this could happen. By the way, the background, this is the depiction of the Gaspé. At the break of dawn on June 10, 1772, they boarded the ship. The crew put up a feeble resistance. Lieutenant Duddingston was shot and wounded, and the vessel burned to the waterline. The man who fired the shot was Joseph Buckland. Buckland was well known in Providence and kept a prominent restaurant or place of resort in South Main Street, where gentlemen resorted for their suppers. Here, too, they assembled to discuss politics and where, possibly, the expedition which destroyed the Gaspé was discussed, as well as at Mr. Sabin's house, who was a rabble-rouser, which was just down the street from it. Previous attacks by the colonials on British naval vessels had gone unpunished. In one case, a customs yacht was actually destroyed, also by fire, with no administrative response. But in 1772, the Admiralty would not ignore the destruction of one of its military vessels on station. The Dockyard Act passed 3 months earlier, and I'm summarizing that there's a lot of bandying about on both sides. But the Dockyard Act passed 3 months earlier in April allowed those suspected of burning His Majesty's vessels to be tried in England. But this was not the law that would be used against the Gaspé's raiders. They would be charged with treason. The Crown turned to a centuries-old institution of investigation, the Royal Commission of Inquiry. The task of the commission was to determine against which colonists there was sufficient evidence for their trial in England. The commission was unable to obtain sufficient evidence and declared their inability to deal with this case. Colonial Whigs were alarmed at the prospect of Americans being sent to England for trial. A committee of correspondence was formed in Boston to consult on the crises. In Boston, a little-known visiting minister, this is for you, Jim Hogan, John Allen preached a sermon at the Second Baptist Church that utilized the Gaspé affair to warn listeners about greedy monarchs, corrupt judges, and conspiracies at high levels in the London government. Allen's sermon was printed 7 different times in 4 colonial cities, becoming one of the most popular pamphlets of colonial British America. This pamphlet, along with the incendiary rhetoric of numerous colonial newspaper editors, awoke colonial Whigs from a lull of inactivity in 1772, thus inaugurating a series of conflicts that would culminate in the battles of Lexington and Concord. There were 38 newspapers in mainland British America in 1772. At least 11, mostly in the Northeast, of course, reported the attack on the Gaspé within the first few weeks following the incident. The Gaspé Commission of Inquiry was the topic of one of the most important pre-independence pamphlets, and most widely read, to circulate within the colonies, John Allen's An Oration Upon the Beauties of Liberty, or The Essential Rights of Americans. Allen, a little-known preacher at the Second Baptist Church in Boston, gave an emotional sermon in December of 1772 that played upon colonial fears and prejudices. He argued that England and America were separate judicial spheres and one could not interfere with the other. He addressed his message to Lord Dartmouth and portrayed the actions of colonials as merely self-defense, not rebellion, an important distinction for his reading audience in early 1773. 3 colonial participants from the attack on the Gaspé documented their memories of that night. Dr. John Monney was the doctor who tended to the lieutenant's wounds. Ephraim Brown, who provided Joseph Buckland with the firearm used to shoot the British lieutenant. And of course, Aaron Biggs, an indentured servant, who gave contemporary testimony that he was an eyewitness to the events of 9 and 10 June 1772. 67 years after the event, Biggs, confident that everyone who was involved was dead, named all of the conspirators. According to Biggs, the men convened at Sabin's Tavern, that John Brown organized a flotilla of 8 boats, and that Abraham Whipple identified himself to the Gaspé lookouts as the sheriff of Kent County. From the Gaspé's crew and officers, there's ample testimony, but Rhode Island's patriots left only scanty information. Essentially, the men got away with the burning of the Gaspé, but it heightened hostilities between England and the colonies and would boil over at the Boston Tea Party in 1773. Independence Hurricane. Well, this is a hurricane that struck the Atlantic seaboard on September 2nd and 3rd, 1775. The Independence Hurricane was a strong tropical storm that took an inland path from North Carolina to Newfoundland. And I put Newfoundland in parentheses. You'll see that in a second. Southeast winds caused the highest tide ever known on the Delaware River, and there was much damage done to shipping. It began in Martinique on August 25th, 1775. And it moved into Newfoundland, although this is disputed by current weather historians, including myself, who feel that it moved into central Pennsylvania and followed the path similar to 1954's Hurricane Hazel. It's now surmised that a second storm struck Newfoundland on September 9, 1775, went right up that bowling alley created by the first. The Newfoundland blow, as some call it, caught many fishing boats on the Grand Banks and drove them ashore. 4,000 sailors, mostly Irish and English, reportedly drowned due to the storm. Total losses in ships, fish, oil, and merchandise exceeded £140,000, $1775. Next up, the Providence hurricane, not Providence, Rhode Island, but a hurricane of Providence. It came at a perfect time. Newport, Rhode Island is under British occupation since December 1776. Troops under Major General John Sullivan and a powerful French fleet under Admiral Comte d'Estaing attempted to wrest control of Newport from the British Army in 1778. When British Admiral Richard Howe heard of the impending battle, he sailed with his fleet from New York Harbor and arrived off of Point Judith, Rhode Island. The French fleet, which had 12 men of war and 4 frigates, was bottled up in Narragansett Bay due to prevailing summer southwest winds. Between 7 a.m. and 8 a.m. on August 10, 1778, a wind squall occurred as a cold front moved through the area. Suddenly, the wind shifted to the north, giving D'Estaing the weather gauge, or the windward position, that all naval men desire when engaging an enemy. Not a Navy guy, so I sailed turnabouts as a kid. Some of the terms that I will use tonight, I'll probably butcher in pronunciation, and I don't master their definition, and I don't claim to be a Navy man. So jump in, any of you Navy fellows here tonight, help us out. The French cut their cables quickly and sailed out into Rhode Island Sound with the wind moderate at northeast, and they slipped past British ships and shore batteries. Opposing fleets were now at equal strength, but Howe, at a wind disadvantage, retired to the southwest, anticipating the return of a normal southwest wind flow. Barometric pressure was rising to the north and falling to the south, and the wind held to the northerly quarter, allowing the French to close to 5 to 6 miles to the rear of the enemy by sundown. The following day, August 11th, the wind hung eastward, blowing fresh. At noon, conditions were logged as thick, hazy weather with moderate east-northeast breeze. D'Estaing thought that he could overtake the enemy and maintain that wind advantage. And again, a lot of this I'm pulling, just so you know, from David Ludlum's Early American Hurricanes book, copyright 1963. Thank you, David. I have a lecture career because of you, sir. And same with Sidney Perley. But instead of typing this out and inflaming my carpal tunnel, I took the shortcut and I just took out what D'Estaing said. And here it is. And you'll see this throughout the lecture. So Admiral D'Estaing, encouraged by his progress and scenting a victory, describes the developments of the afternoon. Quote, "The wind having freshened, we were gaining on them sensibly. An hour and a half after noon, there seemed no more doubt. We believed that we could certainly overtake them. The maneuvers of Lord Howe, who continued to flee before the wind, but losing distance, showed that he no longer flattered himself of escaping combat. The wind and sea increased. Our advance guard, in 5 hours and 3 quarters, had reached the English rear guard, and luffing up, they were engaged. The weather, which for 4 hours had been growing worse and cloudy, was now blowing a gale. At 6 o'clock, I was compelled to take in all sail, except the forestay sail and mizzen trysail. The enemy, of course, was undergoing the same weather experience, and as Thomas O'Byrne, who was aboard a British vessel, describes, the wind at this time blew so fresh that our ships were under close-reefed topsails, and the sea ran so high that Lord Howe could not even return aboard his own ship." I won't press that bad British accent on you anymore. It was a memorable night for Admiral D'Estaing on the Languedoc. Languedoc, Languedoc. Any Frenchmen here? Languedoc. Quote, "At 3:30 in the morning, pardon me, sir, this excess of detail and precision, the man who has had both arms and both legs cut off," you'll see with the ship, that's what he's talking about, "all at the same time, cannot in his sad narrative omit an instant. The bowsprit broke, then the foremast, then the maintop, then the mizzenmast. Finally, mainmast fell. Our rudder broke next. This misfortune was the greatest of all. We were now only a floating mass with nothing to steady us and nothing to guide us." That's a depiction of the Languedoc due to the wind. Another famous lithograph. Late in the afternoon, as he was preparing to engage the British rear line, the wind increased to a gale with high seas. Sails were furled as a hard gale increased to hurricane strength by midnight. The eye,
estimated being 25 to 50 miles to the east. The Languedoc, a huge 90-gun battleship, lost her rudder and was almost dismasted. The French rigged jury masts, hence jury rigging, made repairs at sea and headed to adequate repair facilities in Boston Harbor. On land on August 13th, the storm blew down tents made from sails in a British encampment at Newport, leaving most soldiers without shelter and left standing in the pouring rain. Most of the Indian corn crop was destroyed, and it's estimated that this storm blew for 60 hours. Admiral A.T. Mahan describes the encounter in detail. Quote, "The wind now increased to great violence, and a severe storm raged on the coast until the evening of the 13th, throwing the two fleets into confusion, scattering the ships, and causing numerous disasters. The Apollo lost her foremast and sprung the mainmast on the night of the 12th. The next day, only two British ships of the line and three smaller vessels were in sight of their admiral. Many injuries had been received by the various ships, but they were mostly of minor character, and on the 22nd, the fleet again put to sea in search of the enemy. The French had suffered much more severely. The flagship, Languedoc, 90 guns, had carried away her bowsprit. All her lower masts followed it overboard, and her tiller also was broken, rendering the rudder unserviceable. The Marseillaise, 74 guns, lost her foremast and bowsprit. In the dispersal of the two fleets that followed the gale, each of these crippled vessels on the evening of the 13th encountered singly a British 50-gun ship, the Languedoc being attacked by the Renown, and the Marseillaise by the Preston. The conditions in each instance were distinctly favorable to the smaller combatant, but both unfortunately withdrew at nightfall, making the mistake of postponing to tomorrow a chance which they had no certainty would exist after today. When morning dawned, other French ships appeared and the opportunity passed away." So basically, the British fleet, now scattered over a wide area, limped singularly or in pairs back to New York Harbor. If the French had been able to engage the British while having the advantageous wind, perhaps the Revolutionary War would have been shortened by 3 years with French naval supremacy. The October 1778 storm. Three hurricanes struck the Gulf Coast from Louisiana to Pensacola in three successive years during the American Revolution. The storm of October 7th through 10th, 1778, is mentioned in dispatches by Spanish governor of New Orleans, Bernardo de Galvez, who said, quote, "The sea rose as it had never been seen to do before, and the establishment at Belize, Bayou St. John, and Tiguyu were destroyed." At Pensacola, the British governor wrote to the colonial office, quote, "N.B. The reason of no business being done in the House of Assembly from the 9th to the 15th of October was owing to a very melancholy cause, the severest hurricane ever felt or known in this part of the world since West Florida has belonged to the Crown of Great Britain. It happened on the night of the 9th with such irresistible fury and violence as entirely to sweep away all the wharves, stores, and houses contiguous to the water side, with part of the front batteries of the garrison, besides destroying several houses and making general havoc of the ferries in the town of Pensacola. All of the ships and vessels in the harbor were either lost or driven ashore, except His Majesty's sloop of war, the Sylph, which with difficulty rode out the gale." That's a British man of war. Now, our marquee bouts here. The wreck of the Somerset. Somerset's a 70-gun man of war launched at Chatham, England on July 18, 1746, as a guardship of the British fleet. On October 17, 1774, the Earl of Dartmouth wrote to General Gage in Boston, informing him that he had sent three guardships with British Marines under the command of Major Pitcairn to Boston. They were the HMS Asia, the HMS Boyne, and HMS Somerset. The Somerset, commanded by Captain George Ourry, passed by Boston Light on December 19, 1774, with more than 500 sailors and Marines on board. She dropped anchor between Boston and Charlestown. On April 18, 1775, an alert watchman could have detected two signal lamps flashing from the Old North Church and possibly seen three men in a skiff starting across the harbor. That watchman on the Somerset did not see this vessel. Paul Revere was apprehensive lest the guard on the Somerset should halt them as they rode by, but he escaped by 5 minutes the restraining order, which reached the Somerset from shore. This is in his diaries. Two friends rowed me across Charles River, a little to the eastward where the Somerset man-of-war lay. It was then young flood, the ship was winding, and the moon was rising. Of course, he came ashore. And then all that other stuff started. In his well-known poem, Midnight Ride of Paul Revere, this is for you, Rick, Henry Wadsworth Longfellow mentions the Somerset. Then he said, say it, Rick. Yeah. Then he said goodnight, and with muffled oar, silently rolled to the Charlestown shore, just as the moon rose over the bay, where swinging wide at her moorings lay, the Somerset, British man of war, a phantom ship, with each mast and spar, across the moon like a prison bar, and a huge black hulk that was magnified by its own reflection in the tide. The Somerset lay in Boston Harbor until May 28, 1775, when during the little-known Battle of Chelsea Creek, she laid down a continual fusillade on the defending colonials. The Battle of Chelsea Creek was the second military engagement of the Boston Campaign of the American Revolutionary War. Known as the Battle of Noddle's Island, the Battle of Hog Island, and the Battle of the Chelsea Estuary, it was fought on May 27th and 28, 1775, on Chelsea Creek and on salt marshes, mud flats, and islands of Boston Harbor. The British schooner Diana was destroyed, and its weaponry was appropriated by the colonials. This was the first naval capture of the war, and it was a significant boost to the morale of the colonial forces. After the Diana ran aground on mudflats, American forces boarded it and removed everything of value, guns, rigging, sails, clothing, and of course money. They laid hay under the stern to serve as kindling, and the vessel was set afire at 3 a.m. to prevent it from falling back into British hands. The guns recovered were probably used in American positions during the Battle of Bunker Hill, which is shown in that depiction there. I believe that's the Somerset. Somerset played a large role in the Battle of Bunker Hill. At dawn on June 17, 1775, a deck sentry heard the rattle of picks and shovels coming from the Charlestown shore. Captain Ourry noticed breastworks thrown up on Breed's Hill through a spyglass, weighed anchor, and maneuvered to a position to command Charlestown Neck. After two failed sorties on Breed's Hill, called Bunker Hill by the British, Somerset assisted Clinton's men by rowing in reinforcements with their longboats, ensuring that the third and final assault was successful. Somerset also fired carcasses, that's hot shot or cannonballs, filled with flaming pitch, into Charlestown, setting it ablaze. Somerset returned to England in late 1775, but returned to New England in spring of 1777, capturing and sinking many colonial privateer and supply ships. On Friday, May 30th, 1777, whilst chasing a colonial frigate, not a rigate, Boston, Captain Ourry found Provincetown Harbor to be a suitable and safe port. Just so you know, this is all in dispute. This is where Snow kicks in about if the Somerset actually laid anchor in Provincetown Harbor, because the check of her logs doesn't mention it. Mentions it very infrequently, I should say. There would be frequent visitors, according to Snow, to this port, and the townspeople were quite familiar with these raiders who took supplies of eggs, butter, and meat in exchange for the ship's chaplain's sermons. Steve, remember that song we used to sing, the Cape Cod Girls with the hay and all that? And you'll see that coming up here. Ourry was portrayed as a black-hearted pirate whom the Cape Cod mothers adopted as a symbol of what would happen to children who did not behave. You'll be taken by the bad Captain Ourry. Young women, though, on the other hand, loved to see the spars and sails of the Somerset as they had lovers on board. This is where the Somerset wrecked. Unfortunately, that's right there off the coast of Cape Cod. Just a major shipwreck, New England shipwrecks there. Angel Gabriel, just one of my favorite here, 1635, during the Great Colonial Hurricane. That's one I'm working on right now. The Somerset surgeon, a Dr. William Thayer, would marry Susanna Rich of North Truro. Thayer later became an American citizen, and descendants of the couple lived on Cape Cod well into the 20th century. In late October of 1778, reports came that the French fleet was headed towards Boston, and the Somerset, with over 550 aboard, quickly set sail. This is again in dispute. On November 1st, 1778, an easterly storm began to lash the coast with unusual fury. The Somerset, far out in the bay, tried to make Provincetown as the gale increased. Owry got caught in the dangerous triangle of the Highlands, Chatham, and Pollock Rip Shoals. Graveyard right off the Cape Cod. Okay, there's Provincetown. Soon the dreaded stretches of peaked hill bars could be seen. The great waves began to push the ship towards the reef. The treacherous currents swung her into the sands of the outer bar, and the Somerset's sailing days were over. In Provincetown, residents crowded on High Pole Hill, and the crowd became jubilant. One of the men on the sand dune, a William Spencer, a blacksmith, took a force of men down to the beach, establishing a watch over the shipwreck. With the tide coming in, Spencer sensed that the ship would be delivered to him. On board the doomed Somerset, spar after spar crashed onto the deck, and men were thrown overboard in the great billows that swept over the decks. Captain Owry then ordered abandon ship. All merchandise overboard and guns were forced through their ports. A longboat was manned and launched with roughly 50 sailors. A giant breaker with a huge crest engulfed it, and 21 sailors were lost. Suddenly a wave, and then another, lifted the Somerset off the bar and drove it towards the shore. When the Somerset hit the beach, Spencer and his men cordoned off the area and surrounded it with an armed gauntlet. 2 hours after the tide had receded, Spencer and his men boarded the ship and demanded the surrender of Captain Owry. Owry gave Spencer his sword, and 480 men climbed off of the ship to a hostile crowd swarming on the beach. Then the people began to loot the ship and collect the wealth of the articles that were on the beach. It was one of the most wealthiest hauls ever taken from the Cape. Spencer then headed to Plymouth to libel the ship and prevent the plundering. He wanted to claim it as his own. Joseph Otis described the events at the wreck as, quote, very riotous doings, and he watched in horror and wrote a letter to the council in Boston. Here's the letter. Barnstable, 4 November 1778. Kind sir, I've just received express from the commanding officer of the militia Truro informing me that the Somerset, a British ship, is wrecked about 4 miles east of the race point, and bilged, that they had got out yesterday about 60 men on the captains of the ship and mariners included. The sea is running high. They lost one boatload of them. How many was alive aboard the wreck, they could not tell. Tell you what, this guy, Otis, could be texting modern day the way he writes. Butchering the language. There were some American prisoners aboard who say they parted in the storm with 15 sail of the line bound for Boston. Have ordered an officer from here to go down and assist the officers below in conducting the prisoners along. Who shall march without delay for Boston? But what to do for bread for them, I know not, as there is none to be had where they are, and their own being all wet. Any orders from the Honorable Council, if my conduct is not approved of, please tell to me by word, and they shall be pursued. I send this by express, whose bill I hope will be paid, which he will give in. I am honorably yours, humble servant Joseph Otis. So an immediate reply was sent to Brigadier Otis from the council in Boston. The Massachusetts Board of War approved his actions, yet had no solution to the feeding of the prisoners. Quote, if you have not bread for the prisoners, let them live without, as many better men have done before them. Brigadier Otis sent a Major Hamblin and Colonel Hallett to take charge of the goods at the wreck, but they were halted by Spencer's second-in-command, Colonel Doan, and his band of men who prevented the officers from interfering with what was saved. Otis wrote back to the council that, quote, I have met with nothing more chimerical, and that Spencer was quite haughty. I look on him a poor being and his abettors. 30 of the Somerset's officers were allowed to sail to Boston, while 450 men had to begin a 120-mile walk along the sands of Cape Cod back to Boston in the wintertime. They were ragged, hungry, bruised, and bleeding. From the beginning of their walk until they passed through Eastham, it cost the inhabitants over £450 or $2,000. That's 1778 dollars. After the march proceeded through Sandwich, many Cape residents just gave up and returned back to their homes. So the 450 British Marines and sailors now broke up into bands, some without guards. Some of them escaped to nearby towns like Abingdon and Bridgewater. When authorities heard about this, sheriffs were dispatched to round up the prisoners. Traffic sentinels were set up along the way after they proceeded through Plymouth. Gradually, the prisoners were rounded up and pointed towards Boston. Special guards were placed at Boston Neck to round up the prisoners after their journey. That's, by the way, a cat head that was found from the Somerset. Evidence points to the date of November 13, 1778, as to when they reached Boston, covering 120 miles in less than 13 days. It's estimated that around 50 prisoners escaped before they reached Boston. Those who made it were boarded onto the old French ship, Panay, a very unseaworthy old hulk that was poor for quartering prisoners. An elderly British prisoner, purser Edward Siren, collapsed on the forced march and lay on the road for several days in Braintree. He was released, he was recovered, brought into prison, and then he was released in arrangement with Admiral Byron and then sent to Rhode Island. Five vessels were needed to transport the entire cargo of the Somerset. The sloop Sally brought 16 cannon, they were 18-pounders, and the sloop Cumberland landed 18 cannon at Boston. The Rising Empire made two trips between Provincetown and Boston, loaded with cannon. On April 7, 1779, Paul Revere announced that he had been able to mount several of the Somerset's guns on platforms at Castle Island. Eventually, he would mount 21 of the Somerset's cannons. The British officers were moved to Noddle's Island, where Henry W. H. Williams lived. Williams reminded the billeting officers that his houses were shelled and burned by the Somerset during the Battle of Chelsea Creek. Samuel Sewall's old farmhouse on Hog Island was finally selected as the prison site for the British naval officers. Captain Owry petitioned the Massachusetts Council, January 28, 1779, ordered that this commissary of prisoners of war for this state be and hereby is directed to convey without loss of time from this state to Providence in the state of Rhode Island, Captain Owry and the other officers late belonging to the Somerset, and there caused them to be sent to Newport on Rhode Island, first taking Captain Owry's parole that he will cause Colonel Joseph Ward, now prisoner at New York, and Captain Burke, now on parole here, to be liberated and discharged from parole for his, the said Owry, and one lieutenant arriving there, or to return himself, and the other officers late belonging to the Somerset, to be given in exchange for officers of ours of equal rank. A swap. And first causing the said Owry and other officers at Hog Island to settle their accounts, which they have contracted since their captivity. John Avery. An exchange was agreed upon, and Owry and a lieutenant was moved from Hog Island to Providence. A mate and 13 prisoners escaped from the Panay and surrendered to a captain of one of the American naval ships in the inner harbor of Boston. Shortly afterward, they were impressed into the American Navy. The remaining officers and prisoners were gradually moved to Providence and Newport, and the log of the Somerset never mentions trips into Provincetown or a chaplain preaching to its residents. There's my pal Snow again. The Somerset was dispatched from New York to engage the French fleet. The Somerset's hulk was exposed in 1886 at Dead Man's Hollow. That's an actual picture, photograph, due to a storm. But there was... The American vessel General Arnold now. Let's go to the General Arnold, our next wreck. How much time do I have, Ruth? Because I can stop after this if you'd like, or I can go on to the triple storm. Okay. The American vessel General Arnold sailed from Nantasket Road, Boston Harbor, on Thursday, December 24, 1778, with the privateer Revenge bound for the West Indies. The Revenge, due to its speed and expert navigation by its captain, Mr. Barrows, cleared Race Point at Provincetown and beat the impending storm. The captain of the General Arnold was James McGee. This, by the way, is a colonial ship. The impending gale will be labeled in posterity as the Hessian Storm, the Great Christmas Storm, or McGee's Storm. McGee tried to make Plymouth, but wound up off of Gurnet, a promontory outside of Plymouth Harbor. My beach all my life there. There it is, Saquish Neck. He anchored the General Arnold less than a mile off from the gleam of Gurnet Light instead of trying to get into the harbor without a pilot boat. Some say it's haunted. By midnight, the storm intensified into a gale and the General Arnold was in peril. This is a picture of the Arnold or a rendering of the Arnold. 16 of the vessel's 20 guns were lowered below deck. The topmast struck and the sails furled. Additional line was let out to the anchor. The waves rode higher and higher and the breakers crashed against her. Suddenly, the General Arnold began to drag anchor and she drifted toward Plymouth Bay. With a tremor that jarred the ship from stem to stern, the brigantine scraped the sands of White Flats. Captain McGee ordered the masts cut away, and the crew went below deck to fetch axes. And this can only happen with the Americans. When the men did not return on deck, he went below to find that the men had broken into the rum stores and were drinking heavily. McGee's ship was sinking into the sand, and most of his crew was now drunk. He pleaded with and bullied the men into action. Finally, the masts were cut away. All hands were allowed to retire below deck into the cabin to get some rest. Get some of the creature, I bet. The storm intensified in fury by the hour. This was one of the severest gales ever experienced. In Boston, after the storm, a man would be found with his ox frozen standing up. I'll go over that in just a second. The General Arnold was being battered. The seams of the ship now opened, and water began to gush in. Within an hour, it was 3 feet deep below deck. The crew of 120, which includes McGee, and again, if you look at Snow, he says 105, then moved up to the quarter deck for safety. They lay on top of each other, 3 and 4 deep. Again, bitter, biting cold wind. A tent-like structure was made out of the topsail. As dawn approached, the snowfall became heavy. Some of the men, unable to move, were suffocated under the topsail. Instead of getting lighter with the waning dawn, the skies grew darker and darker. Whiteout conditions ensued. The men were becoming encrusted with an icy sea spray. Officers abandoned any thought of discipline with the crew and made preparations to die. McGee ordered the rest of the rum rations to be doled out. Some sailors poured it down their boots to forestall the freezing of their feet. This activity may have saved some lives. As the day wore on, one of the toughest officers, Captain John Russell, tried to rally the men and urge them to hold on, and then he dropped to the deck and died instantly. The water on the deck was now ankle deep. Just as they thought that all was lost, the tide began to recede. As night fell, many saw this receding tide as an encouraging sign. At dead low tide, the wreck was half exposed on White Flats. Then the wind veered to the northwest around midnight, and a bitter wind chill froze the soaked men's clothes. Some men, due to the weight of their clothes and the inability to move, fell overboard. More than 30 men had been lost. As dawn on the 26th came, a longboat was put over with 3 men who volunteered to row ashore for help. They rowed over to the edge of a solid ice block about a half mile away and walked over to a schooner, went aboard, and abandoned their comrades. The remaining survivors on deck raised a great cry for help, desperately trying to get the attention of Plymouth residents. McGee tied a handkerchief to a stick and waved it frantically. The people in Plymouth did see them hours earlier and had sent out dories, only to have them trapped in ice floes. These were cold times in the late 18th century, where Boston Harbor would freeze over, where you'd get ice off of the shore. It was certainly a cold period, and some point to that as the pinnacle of the mini ice age. That's arguable. The second day wore on. Rescuers set out on a causeway of boards across an ice floe towards the brig, but were still a long way from the vessel. Now came the coldest night, the evening of the 26th of December. By this time, only around 50 men were still alive. That night, including the wind, the temperature dipped well below zero. With the biting, icy air, the remaining survivors of the General Arnold had to take desperate measures. They stacked up the frozen corpses of their comrades to form a windbreak on deck and then sat down in a circle inside the cadaver barricade, my term, and crossed their legs over one another. They moved their legs back and forth to restore circulation in their bodies. When one fell asleep, the others would shake him awake. This is how they passed the second night. As dawn on the 27th came, the sun rose in a cloudless sky. Many men had perished, literally frozen stiff with their legs crossed, their arms folded or straight out in front of them, some clinging to the half-mast. The Plymouth men continued building the ice causeway and were making great progress across the ice floe. At 10 a.m., they were within hailing distance of the ghost ship. Soon, the sleds and boards were moved close enough to the brig and contact was established. It's said that the men who boarded the General Arnold on that bitter morning never forgot what they witnessed. With all the men huddled together, most frozen stiff, it was impossible to distinguish between the dead and the dying. As Barnabas Downs of Barnstable lay on the deck, he could not indicate to the rescuers who walked past him that he was still alive. he heard the men refer to him as dead. As they lifted his body to be thrown into a corpse pile, he managed to roll his eyes, and one of the rescuers saw him do it. He was then placed on a sled and taken ashore over the causeway. Barnabas Downs, up Barnstable, was taken to a Plymouth home and placed into a tub of cold water. After 3 hours immersion, he was revived enough to suffer excruciating pains as the blood began to circulate through his thawing limbs. Downs later said the pain was much worse when he was regaining circulation than it was when he was freezing to death. Captain McGee was brought ashore and attributed his survival to the rum that he poured in his boots. Those who drank the rum died first. 70 of the 83 corpses, and again, these numbers fluctuate depending on monuments, Edward Rowe Snow, Purley, Ludlam, and other historians, were brought to Plymouth, and 20 were placed in the town brook to thaw out so they could fit into coffins. 66 of the 74 who had frozen to death were buried in one grave. A mass funeral at Plymouth Courthouse was presided over by preacher Reverend Dobbins. He promptly fainted during the service. Many of the crew actually came from Cape Cod. The last survivor, Cornelius Marchant, died in 1838. And meanwhile, out at Nantucket, the sloop General Stark ran ashore with the loss of 20 hands. Many, many wrecks were reported along the southern New England shoreline, Long Island and New Jersey, during this storm. In Kittery, Maine, a prominent pastor, Reverend Chase, was discovered frozen to death in a field. And again, reiterating, on Boston Neck, a driver with his team of four oxen and a horse were found after the winds abated, quote, solidly congealed and standing upright. Frozen solid. Captain James McGee went on to become a prosperous merchant, eventually buying the Shirley Eustis House, the former Massachusetts governor's house in Roxbury. He never forgot that deadly Christmas night in Plymouth Harbor, though, and he would host a Christmas party every year and invite the surviving crew members and their widows and children of those who had perished. He became wealthy in the China trade business. Due to the deep snow, word did not leave Plymouth about the disaster for several days. Barnstable lost 12 men, and when Barnabas Downs Sr. arrived on the scene by horseback, only his son was alive out of the 12 Barnstable boys. An improvised ambulance, a feather bed slung between two horses, was made, and Downs Jr. was lowered onto it. Young Barnabas Downs was taken to Barnstable that evening. Although he was given the best medical care, he never fully recovered and lost the use of his feet. He had to walk on his knees for the rest of his life, and he became a prominent citizen in Barnstable. Of the 120 on board the General Arnold, 33 came ashore alive and 9 died shortly afterwards. 15 recovered completely and 8 were crippled for life. This is a memorial here, put up in 1862. In the 1970s, as the breakwater was being built in Plymouth, the supposed wreck of the General Arnold was found. And then the rancor ensued. There was a very public salvage rights dispute. Barry Clifford, who discovered the Wida, was involved with it. Subsequent artifacts, including pottery, shoes, cutlery, rum bottles, were recovered by Charles Sanderson and dated back to the late 18th century. Clifford and the Plymouth Historical Society, however, insisted that it was an old coal barge that was found. They maintained that the General Arnold was repaired and refloated and returned to duty. It's still a mystery. Dunbar's Hurricane, 1779. By 1779, Spain had declared war on Britain, with military objectives being the British holdings along the Gulf Coast and the Mississippi River. Governor Bernardo de Galvez, we spoke about him earlier, was preparing in secret an expedition to seize the British post at Baton Rouge. On August 18, 1779, a severe storm lashed New Orleans. The governor describes the storm and its devastating impact. Basically, he says, although the wind and rain began on the night of the 17th, it wasn't until 3 o'clock in the morning that it attained its full violence, keeping its strength continually until 10 o'clock. Just moving down a bit. He's talking about people being disturbed. Among the frigate America La Rezata and one belonging to Don Bernardo Ogaban, others have gone aground, half destroyed and useless, stranded in the woods, and finally there are others of whose fate we are still ignorant. To aggravate the situation, the schooners and gunboats have also sunk. From London Magazine, they printed this article. We've had here on the 18th of August the most dreadful hurricane that was ever remembered. All the vessels that were in the river were either sunk or blown on shore. Among the number of those that were sunk was the Morris, an American frigate commanded by Captain Pickles, and some of her crew drowned, as were several other persons who were on board of vessels in the river. Great numbers of houses in the town, though very low, were entirely blown down, and all others suffered very considerably. All of the plantations from the bottom of the river to 6 or 7 leagues above the town were entirely laid waste. Trees in the forest were torn up for several miles together. The disaster that the hurricane occasioned is so great that it will require 2 or 3 years' labor to put the country in the state it was before. All of the vessels that Galvez planned to use in this expeditionary force were severely damaged, with the exception of El Volante. 4 smaller ships were raised, and the attacking force moved northward on the 27th of August, only a week behind schedule. William Dunbar, a mathematics and astronomy scholar who was in New Orleans at the time, published a compelling account of the 1779 hurricane in his Remarks of the Climate of Mississippi, which was published in 1804. He describes the eye of the storm passing directly over New Orleans. Quote, vessels were left upon dry land or dashed in pieces against the shores. An American armed ship being overset was precipitated into the ocean and never more heard of. The officers and men were chiefly saved by leaping ashore, sometimes by the assistance of rafts and logs of timber, watching the opportunity of the vessel impinging against the bank as she darted from side to side of the river, hurled along by the ungovernable fury of the torrent. And I can wrap up here quickly. The occupation storm, Charleston, South Carolina, surrendered to the British forces, which was 5,400 men and 4 ships, on May 12, 1780. On August 10, 1780, and you'll see there's a very violent year of hurricanes from 1778 to 1783, unprecedented in American meteorological history. A severe wind and rainstorm, probably a tropical storm, struck Charleston. The wind began to blow on Thursday night, August 9th at 7 p.m. At 4 o'clock on the 10th, according to the Royal Gazette, it blew a mere hurricane. The ships at anchor in the harbor fared better than those who were tied to the wharves. The British ships Thetis and London sank at their docks, but the London was raised 4 days later. Vessels in the bay dragged their anchors and were swept ashore. According to eminent weather historian William Redfield, the gale blew for 40 straight hours. Okay, we're in the home stretch. We're going to get home on this. Beautiful. The triple hurricanes of 1780. This chart shows you Solano Storm, the Savannah-Lamar Hurricane, and the Great Hurricane of 1780. The devastation was almost unbelievable. The Louisiana Hurricane, I'm just going to go right to the account here, Charles Guyer, says, quote, on the 24th of August 1780, as if intended to be the last pound of weight wanting to break the camel's back, a hurricane, much more furious than the one which had prevailed the year preceding, that was Dunbar's, on the 18th of the same month, swept over the province, destroying all the crops, tearing down the buildings, and sinking every vessel or boat which was afloat on the Mississippi or the lakes. Now, the Savannah-Lamar Hurricane. The first of the October series of hurricanes aimed a savage blow at western Jamaica on the afternoon and evening of the 3rd of October. The settlement of Savannah-Lamar near the southwestern corner of that island of Jamaica is said to have been completely destroyed by the combined force of wind and the storm tide, which flowed one half mile beyond the shoreline to engulf and destroy all the buildings of the erstwhile thriving seaport. A tremendous storm surge. Several hundred persons were thought to have perished. The principal first-hand account occurred in the Royal Jamaican Gazette of 12 October 1780, basically talking about the gale and how it lasted in force until 8 that night, destroying all the houses around the bay. And basically the ships, Princess Royal, Captain Ruffin, Henry Richardson, and Austin Hall, were forced from their anchors and carried so far into the morass that they will never be got off. The earthquake, now there's some dispute here. Some think it's an earthquake that struck at the same time as a hurricane. Others think that the force was just due to the pounding waves and the storm surge. Seismological records are indifferent to this. They don't really show a major earthquake, or at least the faults that they've studied in that area don't show an earthquake taking place in the late 18th century. The earthquake lifted the Princess Royal from her beam ends, rightened her, and fixed her on her firm bed. But this is... The morning ushered in a scene too shocking for description. Bodies of the dead and dying scattered about the watery plains where the town stood presented themselves to the agonizing view of the Son of Humanity, whose charity led him in the quest of the remains of his unhappy fellow creatures. The number who have perished is not precisely ascertained, but it's imagined. 50 whites and 150 persons of color are lost. In the whole parish, it's said that there are not 5 dwelling houses and not 1 set of works remaining. The plantain walks, all destroyed. All the cane fields destroyed. Basically, the center must have been just to the east of HMS Bristol. When a sudden shift of wind from east-northeast to northwest took place, most of Admiral Rowley's ships, I think he means Rodney, suffered split sails, broken booms, and several lost their main masts. But I want to get to the Great Hurricane. This is all taken from Ludlam, by the way. On the 6th and 7th, the HMS Terrible, the Cyclops, the Triumph, and the Guadalupe suffered such damage that the entire squadron had to be put into port for repairs. Admiral Rodney gave a valuable clue as to the extent of this hurricane by stating that his flagship, off Sandy Hook, experienced fine weather throughout, but that another group off Rhode Island had a severe blow at the same time, the wind veering from east-northeast to west-northwest, with strong gales and squalls with rain. Good, and we can just conclude with this. The Great Hurricane, devastating. October 10th to the 12th, 1780, it hit the Windward and Leeward Islands of the Caribbean, Jamaica, and Puerto Rico. It is estimated that 20,000 to 30,000 people died due to this hurricane. It sank the British fleet anchored off the coast of St. Lucia, drowning 6,000 sailors. They're told of in Grenada of great devastation on shore, 19 sails of the loaded Dutch ships stranded and beat to pieces. In the evening, the wind was felt much more severe in the harbor, so much that His Majesty's ships, which lay far out, were in danger of parting from their anchors. Finally, it said, it would seem as if the former part of the gale was intended to prepare the mind for the redoubled violence with which in the afternoon it increased, the eye passing over, from 3 to 5, which was esteemed the height of it. Those vessels which had rode it out were torn from their anchors and carried with astonishing force against the other shipping. And finally, just in Martinique, all the ships were blown off the island that were bringing troops and provisions and the lives of more than 3,000 soldiers and seamen they have on board, much dreaded. They were lost. On the 12th, 4 ships foundered in Port Royal Bay and could not save a soul. Every other ship was blown out of the roads and many must, of course, be lost. So it's just talking about other people dying. I'm going to conclude there, I think. The Earthpins was a ship, a Dutch ship that was lost, 303 hands were lost. In 1783, it was an escort ship for a Dutch dignitary. But that's my talk for tonight. Thank you very much for your time. I appreciate that. My acting teacher told me that I used to do 2-hour plays in an hour and 20 minutes, so I apologize if I spoke too quickly. But any questions, comments, corrections, anecdotes?
The hurricane in Chesapeake Bay in 1781,
Yeah. The anti-cyclone? It's almost like you're exactly, right. Basically, I call it the victory anti-cyclone. When you have all these nuances, it takes a while to toggle through. But what Doug is talking about is a change of winds that allowed DeGrasse to sneak in and supply I call it the Chesapeake Bay anti-cyclone. But I'm not going to go through this, but basically, British naval command of the Atlantic allowed them to choose the point of their attack, transport their forces at will, achieve military superiority. But D'Estaing arrived with 24 ships of the line. He wanted to take on Rear Admiral Thomas Grave, who was sent to relieve Cornwallis at Yorktown. And basically, the winds shifted such that DeGrasse could get a fleet of ships in to supply the colonials and help them secure victory at Yorktown. I'm not an expert at Yorktown. I couldn't give you the description of the battle, but it's amazing how it wasn't a major storm. It was just an anti-cyclone where winds go clockwise, and it actually allowed the French fleet to sneak by and get into Chesapeake Bay and provision the colonials.